Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. Is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo lets you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code SOUTHERN10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
Before I did this for a living, I did GIS for a living. So I did maps and data science and stuff. And I got a hold of that data. So I took those GPS points, put them in my software.
Before AI.
Before AI. I plotted them on a map, and we were looking at these bucks, and we were able to see all these GPS points. There was one buck in particular that kind of was the perfect poster child of why I quit paying so much attention to individual beds. And he bedded, there's a big hillside of thinned pines. And then in the bottom was a pretty wide hardwood creek drainage. And this buck bedded in that pine thicket all day and then went straight down to that hardwood drainage every day and night for like 28 days in a row. So he bedded in the same pine thicket and went to the same hardwood bottom within a couple hundred yards every single night for 28 days in a row, almost a month. And the reason that it broke me of that is because he bedded in a different spot every single day, and he entered the creek bottom in a different spot every single day. Welcome back, everybody, to another Thursday Q&A hot take edition of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast. We just wrapped up the World Deer Expo this past weekend. We had a great time, and we got the Mobile Hunters Expo coming up next, which is our favorite show of the entire year. So August, what is it, 14th, 13th?
14th through the 16th.
14th through the 16th, Dalton, Georgia, Dalton Convention Center. You excited?
Oh, yeah. It's the best expo. You keep calling it a show, and some people are like, what do you mean by show? It's expo, hunting expo.
Yeah.
It is phenomenal, so don't miss it. But this week, we got some really good Q&As and some hot takes from our circle community.
Which, at the Deer Expo, we talked to so many people. And dude, my hand hurts from shaking hands at that expo. So appreciate everyone who came by. But do you know how many people I had walk up to me saying how much they like the hot takes?
Oh,
dude, I had a bunch.
I had somebody talk about the hot takes, but I just met a lot of circle members at the expo. So, and all of my ass was like, have you been on one of our hunters hangouts yet? The video meetings? They're like, no. Like half, only I think one of them had joined, or a couple of them had joined before. Most of them like, oh man, I'm busy working. I kind of forget about it. I'm like, well, we're doing one tonight, so go check it out. Not, you know, we're recording this not on Thursday, so tune into Circle for next week's hunters hangout, which is on Tuesday.
All right, let's get started. This is a good one to start out with. We're going a little bit out of order here. If you're on the circle and you're looking at the post or whatever, but this is from Sam Brown, and he said, I think there are more big bucks close to roads and parking lots than there are deep and remote areas where no one really goes. I agree, and we have an episode that backs this up. Gino D'Angelo, Dr. Gino D'Angelo, from Georgia, University of Georgia, doing GPS studies on deer, particularly in North Georgia, found that to be the case. That now, the only caveat to this is I think it depends on what the habitat and everything looks like, but he found that, especially in big wood settings, that is absolutely the case. And he was saying that the reason for that is you have more diversity next to the roads. Like, you have the edge of the shoulders of the road where more sunlight can get into the woods. So not only do you have the grassy right away on the edges of the road most of the time and the grassy ditches, but also going into the woods a little bit, you'll have a little bit different vegetation structure, basically. So it's going to be more saplings, higher stem count, more shrubs, more grass, as opposed to if you walk in a mile into the middle of this big closed canopy forest, there's like nothing really in there. So there's not much to hold the deer. Plus, people are probably walking past all that and spooking the deer back closer to the roads. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of based off where you're at. There are some places that we hunt that have tons of roads, and you truly just can't get a mile from any one road. You start walking that far, you're going to hit another road system. But in a lot of places, like you said, like the diversity, especially if it's places that they're not doing a lot of logging, and or depending on what the pressure's like, you have deer slapped right next to the road, or again, especially roads like where there's a main road that goes through a property. I say main road, like a drive-through road, and there's dead-end roads.
Yep.
It seems like there's a lot of deer close to the main road. Everybody drives down the secondary roads, goes to where it stops, and then keep walking. And there's a whole gap of space right there. That deer doesn't really get a whole bunch of pressure.
Yeah,
that's not everywhere, but we've had tons of podcast guests on the show talk about that. Mike Rex recently over the summer in Ohio, he talked about that, like some of the best spots that he's found in public were very close to access points or places where people frequented a whole bunch, but people would walk in way deeper. I can't think of some other ones off the top of my head just at this moment, but I know we've had that conversation with a lot of individuals who've had success a lot closer to the roads, just catching bucks like at all times of the year. There was one deer on some public land years ago. I say years ago, probably not that long, 5 years ago, on a piece of public land we used to hunt all the time, where a big buck kept getting seen crossing this one road interior to the public land all the time. Like, we had buddies that seen him. I never saw the deer. I don't think you ever saw the deer. We had personal buddies seen him and heard from a bunch of other guys that saw that same deer. Deer never got killed. And he was in a spot that people were hunting the general area, but nobody was hunting probably within 300 yards of where he was crossing.
Yeah.
Because, like, how the habitat and everything laid out.
Okay, yeah, I know. And, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And
I think that was only about 3 years ago.
Anyway, supposedly he'd been seen for a couple years, though.
Yeah.
And, yeah, nobody seemed to ever kill that deer. Because every time someone wanted it, also where he was at, there was no real good trees to get in within that buffer. So you had to, like, kind of go way out of the way to try to find a spot. If you're going to climb up in a tree, and that might have been a spot you probably could kill him on the ground, because it wasn't long. It was, you know, right at last light, people were seeing him. They'd get back to the trucks early, drive, and he'd be crossing the road right there.
Yeah.
So, but I think it's just indicative to, like, just different areas. You know, if you start talking about areas of better managed timber, you know, you got cutting going on, yeah, you're gonna have logging roads going to it. And he doesn't specialize, is this main roads, is this logging roads, is this like gated roads, you know, drivable roads, all that kind of stuff. But if you have a lot more habitat diversity further back, it's like there could be great habitat for a deer to be able, you know, get some age on and also some ruggedness to kind of, you know, get big or get old. So I think it's indicative to where you're at, but
yeah,
for a lot of us down here in the South, it seems like the case. You know, everybody seems to, you know, you always hear stories about someone killing a real big deer right behind the skin shed or the camp house or whatever on a piece of property, or the check-in station on a piece of public land.
Yep.
And because sometimes it's just overlooked. Nobody wants to hunt right there.
Yep, that's right. And it always goes back to the habitat diversity, too. It kind of reminds me of some places that we hunt where you can go really deep. And when you do go deep, I mean, there's deer in there, but they're not just like all over the place. There's not a ton of them. They're going to be in concentrated little pockets, and it's always around diversity of some kind where there's just something different back there. And also another thing, you kind of brought this up. We have so many roads in the South that a lot of times if you walk that far, you end up walking back into pressure. So if you're trying to get away from hunting pressure, ironically, if you walk too far, you walk into another road. So it's kind of like that, you know, Onyx has the roadless layer, which is not super useful in most places in Alabama because we have so many roads. I think that layer set to where it starts shading when you get more than a mile from a road. And if you go switch that thing on, there's very few places where you can see that it's actually like it meets the criteria for what that layer is. So you got to kind of think of it that way too, where there's just not that many places where you can get that far from a road. So if it's 1 mile as a crow flies from this road to that road, and you walk 3/4 of a mile, you just walked pretty dang close to another road. You walked really far just to get close to another road.
Yeah. And Andrew Longy, I'm sorry, Andrew, I'm going to botch your name, not Maxwell. Circle member, he had a comment on here saying that he agreed with this one, talking about bucks being close to the roads. One of my best spots I watch vehicles go up a bridge or down or turn around another county road. Anyways, watching him go up and down the roads, he's less than 75 yards from both roads and shoot bucks out of that spot every single year. And we've had other guys talk about that. Back when old Michael Pike was on the podcast, we always used to talk about, and he used to talk about the whole like Y in a road.
Yep.
Where you have like a main road and it splits like on, like say, a piece of public, and there's that gap in between the two roads. You know, some of them might be 250 yards wide, some might be 100 yards wide, some might be even wider. But always seemed to be just a hot spot for finding a buck. And it's just an area that, you know, he can kind of work through there. He's got habitat diversity because all those roads going through there. Again, vegetation on the side of the roads. He can kind of go a little unnoticed, and nobody's going to think, like, oh, I'm just going to park here and walk into that Y. Every time we talk about it on the podcast, we always get negative comments. So, like, why did y'all talk about that? Because a lot of people, there seems to be quite a few guys that hunt public specifically or on hunting clubs use that to their advantage and kill some really nice deer doing that. But, yeah, they don't have to be super far off the roads. But I think, again, it's just based off where you're at.
Yeah. Before we move on, Sam had a prediction as well.
Yep.
Sam predicts that I will kill the first buck this year, but Jacob will kill the bigger buck this year. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's pretty accurate. I'm the only one with the, I'm the only one with the Iowa tag, so we'll see.
That is true.
He didn't specify where the deer had to get killed. He didn't say Alabama or anything like that.
That is very true.
You know, there's some opportunity there.
Going to be hard to compete with that one, boys.
Yeah.
Gonna be hard to compete.
When we go to our other state on a bow hunt, you know, the bar is not as high, I think, set. Well, it's a good place to go, but it's like, I don't know if I'm passing a 130-inch deer come walking by me.
So. Yeah. All right. Now we got an interesting one. I'm very curious on what everybody in the comments, everybody listening and watching thinks of this, because I've never heard of this before.
Yeah.
All right. This is from Joshua Fungi. I think I pronounced your name right. He said, question, have y'all ever located bucks in the early season by the sound that they make when they are still in bachelor groups going, traveling through thickets at dawn, dusk, and sometimes at night? I've heard some people call it a whistle, but to me it sounds more like a low horse sound, like a wee.
Did you do that sound again? What's
wee?
The sound?
Wee. I don't know. I've called in multiple bachelor groups with a can call and scratch the tree when I hear them. It's just always too late to be able to shoot. I wish I had actual audio. Might try to get audio this year.
Talking about scratch tree, sounds like Michael Pike, like a buck making a rub. He used to talk about that all the time, dude.
Taking
that boot and scratching that pine tree. Yeah.
Have you ever heard that?
No.
Like a horse sound?
No.
What kind of horse sound? I don't know. I ain't spent much time around horses. So
I've spent more time now than you have around horses, but still have no idea what that is.
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
Does somebody have audio of this that they can send in?
Or personal experience where you've heard something like what Josh is talking about here.
And then Joshua's talking about calling him in with a can call in early season Bachelored Up. Interesting. I've never heard of such a thing. And we've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of something like that.
That's what we call a curveball question, which ain't bad. It's interesting.
I like
this conversation.
I have nothing of substance to add here.
Yeah.
I'm just surprised. I would love to hear what people think about that.
Yeah. If you're especially on YouTube and you leave a comment below and let us know. Because, I'm interested if someone's heard bucks do that. I've heard, like, soft grunting. But never anything that sound like, as he said, some people call it a whistle, or he calls it that horse sound.
Can you make the horse sound?
No, I'm good. I think you did a pretty good job at it. But, that's a curveball. I have no idea. But, yeah, so, Josh, I guess to kind of answer your question, no, we never located bucks in early season by the sounds they make.
Mm-mm.
Hasn't been the case.
I have heard them in early season sparring with each other. Just tickling the old antlers together. Yeah. I have heard that.
I mean, yeah.
But never tried to do that.
Deer munching on acorns, walk through the leaves, don't know what it is till you see them.
Yep.
I've heard deer cough and or snort because they have a flash and they get up their nose, and it's kind of funny to watch it.
I have heard a doe bleat before. I've only heard it maybe one time.
In early season?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it... Yeah, I guess kind of early season. It would be... It was mid-November. Because it was on a youth
hunt.
That's
still early season for most of them.
Well, around there, the rut kind of starts kicking off about Thanksgiving. So we weren't really that early season.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, it sounded like a girl off in the woods going, yeah. That's what it sounded like.
You sure wasn't a person? Did you see the deer?
Yeah, I saw the deer.
Okay.
I heard the bleat first. And I was like, what was that? I thought it was a person in the woods.
They're just like, I didn't bring a gun with me.
Oh, you know what? Maybe it was earlier than that. Because you know what I had? I had a crossbow. We're talking about crossbows. I was crying with a crossbow. It was before youth season.
Where the truth comes out.
Or maybe I was 16 and I couldn't youth hunt anymore. and had me a crossbow that weekend. I don't know. I don't remember. But anyways, I heard it, and it was weird. That's the only time I've ever heard it, though. I've never heard one since then.
I can't recall ever hearing a doe bleat. I mean, I have heard them bleat, but it was because of me. The shot execution.
But
yeah, that's different. Very different. Anyways, Josh, we appreciate the question. That's a curveball. Again, guys, you know, please leave us a comment down below if you heard anything like that in early season. And if so, I don't know. Just I want to know some personal experience. But yeah, super interesting there.
All right, let's get to some of these terrain questions. We got several terrain questions, which I always enjoy. This one's from Logan Bridges. He said, do you think elevation changes and terrain features play as big a role in deer bedding and movement in the rolling hills and flatlands of the southeast as much as they might play in the foothills and the Appalachians? Do they still funnel deer movement in the exact same way but on a much smaller scale? Or do they not have as much of an effect on movement and deer might move based off thickness of vegetation or other limiting factors to travel? That's a great question. What do you think?
I'll say, because he puts rolling hill country and flatland in the same category, which I would not do. In flatland, I don't think the subtle terrain differences make a huge difference unless there is a vegetation component of cover associated with it. Like a low little drainage, and it's just real thick in there, thick and wet. Yeah, they might use the edge of it. Or flip side, if you're hunting around any kind of agriculture or anything like that, if you got a low drainage, even in flat land, it's like 3 feet lower, that goes out into that field, I guarantee most times than not, first off, there's going to be some brush right around the edge of the field right there because they're not going to go across that drainage very well until and combine it. But deer will enter from that spot. Like, they'll enter into that field from that low spot.
Yep.
But, yeah, it's not as significant. Hill country, there's different levels of hill country.
Yes.
Because I've had people, and I mean, there's just different levels of hill country. If you're in an area where it's like 20 to 30, maybe 40 feet of elevation change, It's really not going to make a huge difference. Like, deer can truly walk wherever they want. But you will find areas that they will want to use more so than not. But a lot of times it is truly based on habitat edges, habitat diversity, And so on. Like, they're not using a saddle as efficiently, or they don't have to use a saddle, should I say, with 30 to 40 foot elevation change from the bottom of a little creek drainage to the top of a little ridge. In that they will, but it's not like as pressing as if you're talking higher elevation, bigger elevation stuff. Andrew's going to have a different take on that, but it is, yeah, I think really the big thing is, because a lot of people talk about, man, y'all talk about terrain so much, and it's because we're interested in, like, where we're at, it's bigger hill country. Mm-hmm. Like, you got certain areas where, like, truly you could have 100-foot elevation change, 150-foot elevation change, that's kind of like max for a lot of it. There's some areas that we'll go to is a lot bigger than that. But, like, in that kind of elevation change, I feel like that can it plays a big factor for them. But, like, the subtle rolling hills are, like, the real gentle rolling hills. When I say gentle, it's like you look at it and it'd be, like, three topo lines. And it's, like, yeah, it's, like, 20-foot elevation, but it's, like, real gradual, like, drops And rises. And I just feel like more times than not, the deer will still use those low spots crossing some of them. But, again, I think it's also associated with some kind of cover type vegetation. Because, again, especially a buck likes to move with some, like, on the edge of some kind of cover as he's traveling, if he can, especially kind of later on in the season when there's less and less vegetation. So,
disagree.
I know you did. I can agree. That's perfectly fine. Hit me with it.
All right. So, I agree on the flatland part. If you're truly in flatland, it's just different. Like, if you do have a little bit of a low draw, I think they'll use it, but they don't have to. And I do think that you hit a certain point where, yeah, the habitat has more to do with it than the actual terrain. But a lot of times, the habitat and the terrain coincide with one another. So if we're talking to guys in the river bottoms of Arkansas, they're talking about terrain, but the terrain they're talking about is 1 foot, 2 foot of elevation change. And it's literally just a high ridge. They call it a ridge. It's literally a foot, like one step on a staircase higher than the rest of the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And it might even be kind of drawn out, but because it's a little bit higher and maybe it doesn't flood as much or water doesn't sit on it as much, there's usually something different there. Like maybe there's briars growing on it, or maybe there's different trees that can survive right there. Like a different kind of oak tree is one that we hear from, like, I think Richard Fought, Benji Vogt.
Yeah, red oak ridges.
Yeah, red oak ridges in the swamps. So there's that. So I think, is it the terrain? Is it the habitat? I don't really know. It's maybe a little bit of both. It's probably more the habitat than the terrain.
That terrain allows for those red oaks to grow where they would get swamped out.
Yep.
So that's why
the chicken or the egg, bro.
Yeah. It's like, are they there because the red oaks are there and they're dropping, or are they there because it's 2 foot of elevation change versus everything else around it?
Yep. So I don't look at it as total elevation change. So if you've got 40 foot of elevation change is more than enough, in my opinion, to get a deer to move in a certain way for terrain. What matters more is how drawn out is that terrain. So is that 40 feet of elevation change, is that happening over 50 to 100 yards, or is it happening over a quarter mile, right? So, like, is it just super gentle, moving up very, very slowly, and it's, like, truly very gentle rolling terrain, or is it just small hills? Because if it's small hills, but the grade of it is a little bit steeper, I feel like that has a much larger effect. Mm-hmm. So, like, where I killed my second buck last year, our club's got pretty good terrain on it. But where I killed that buck at is kind of on a low, flat ridge where the elevation change is probably only about 30 foot, and the saddle on top that these bucks are crossing through is maybe from the bottom of the saddle to the high spots on either side of it is maybe 5 feet elevation difference. But every deer I see cross right there goes through that saddle. They almost never, or I didn't see a single deer come out on the high side of that saddle, like on the top of that ridge. They all cross through that little saddle. And again, there's bigger hills around it, but that is a small hill and it's very gentle. So it's not like aggressive terrain forcing them to walk. They just like that low spot.
I've got a question on that. Is there any vegetation difference between where that saddle is versus on the top side of said saddle with that 5 foot elevation change?
No, because it's all grassy longleaf pines. There are little thick spots in it, kind of like fire shadows, but they're more randomly dispersed throughout it. It's not like it runs up the side of that saddle and empties out into the road or anything like that. So I don't think that it's the habitat. I think it's truly they just prefer. And the other saddle, there's two saddles on this road where it goes through one and then it goes up and it curves a little bit and it goes down through another one. Those two saddles where I see all the deer. The far saddle, which is where I saw the 11 point last year, that one's even more gentle. It's probably like 3 or 4 feet. I mean, maybe. I don't know. I got to go out there and kind of look at it and measure it again. But like if I'm standing in the bottom of the saddle flat footed, I can see across the top of the high spot. And so it's not a very deep saddle.
Mm-hmm.
But they just like those low spots. So in rolling hill country, like what most of us have in the Southeast, like most people in the Southeast have some kind of hills. It's not, most places aren't truly, truly flat unless you're in like a big river floodplain type setting. I think that the terrain does play a big difference in movement and paying attention to those low spots and compounding it with a terrain or a habitat feature is even better. So if you've got one of those low spots and there's a habitat edge, then that's really good.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LiDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LiDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LiDAR is now available on Onyx Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LiDAR feature and boom, it's gonna come on and you're gonna see what I'm talking about. The LiDAR is gonna allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LiDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LiDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on Onyx Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your Onyx Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LiDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Y'all have heard me say it a bunch over the years. I love having a diversified freezer. Obviously, we eat a lot of venison around our house, and if I can have some fish in the freezer, maybe some small game, that's even better. But the truth is, I still eat plenty of beef, and I like having really good beef on hand without having to make another trip to the grocery store. That's one of the reasons I've used Omaha Steaks. They help me keep my freezer stocked, and when we decide we want burgers or steaks, I already know I've got the quality meat ready to go. Everything comes individually vacuum sealed, so I can pull out exactly what I need instead of having to thaw a whole pack, just like how I do with my wild game, and it's consistently really good. It's like going to a really nice butcher without having to go to a really nice butcher. One thing I'm really excited to try is their Burger Perfection Flight. So they've got burger made out of all these different cuts like ribeye, filet, New York strip, brisket, and sirloin. And I've had the brisket burgers before and they are excellent. And the cool thing about the Burger Perfection Flight is you can taste the different cuts, the different textures, and kind of get a feel for everything at once. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99 plus get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. See site for details. If you're traveling to hunt this fall, you need to check out Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone to rent an RV or a camper without owning one. I'm going to be honest with you guys, I wish I knew about this sooner. There's been a couple hunts over these last few years where, you know, depending on where you're going to hunt, there might not be good hotel options, there might not be good rental house options. So, I mean, this is perfect for the traveling hunter. They've got thousands of RVs and campers nationwide available right in your neighborhood. You got multiple ways that you can travel. You can drive it yourself, you can tow it, or you can have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. Outdoorsy also has built-in peace of mind. They've got comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance included. So not only is this a good option to give you a good place to stay even when you're going somewhere pretty remote to go hunting, but it's also often more affordable than hotels, especially if you got a good group of guys going with you. So how it works is you just search and choose an RV that fits your trip and your group size, you book it with confidence, and then you hit the road, whether you're driving, towing, or getting it delivered. And right now, listeners of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast can have all service fees removed from their booking in 2026 with show code OUTDOORSMAN at outdoorsy.com. That's OUTDOORSY.com and use the code OUTDOORSMAN at checkout to remove all service fees.
Good. Well, typically, now I think about it, the more when you have that change of terrain, elevation, I say elevation, just like it's not flat. Like there, it rises, it falls, there's low spots. That is going to be indicative because of the way the ground is where certain vegetation is going to grow. It's going to get thicker in certain spots than other spots, which is typically going to be always around those little low spots. Spots that, first off, are hard from the cut if a logging crew comes in there, but also holds more moisture. It seems like the vegetation that grows up in those spots are going to grow up faster, taller. There's a little bit more density to it. So it's like that low spot acts two things. Yeah, it's the easiest point of travel, but like they could cross that ridge at any point. But it's like you could be walking and all of a sudden if you can see that vegetation change just subtly. And also another thing is if you're standing up looking at it, like you're talking about going through that little low spot, that saddle, and you can see across it, well, you're standing 2.5 feet, 3 feet taller than a deer's vision, where the deer's eyes are. So if a deer's even lower, like you're squatting down, pretty much got a knee on the ground with your head up, it's about where that buck's head's gonna be. Mm-hmm. He's even more hidden per se right there, but also the vegetation is gonna look a lot different for him than you walking through the woods. That's when I feel like in the past I've written stuff off of like, oh, this isn't that good vegetation because it looks like you see over it, but if you get down deer's level, it's like, oh no, there's a noticeable difference. It's all like waist high to like chest high stuff. That's just a little more obstructive than if you're standing up and you can see right over it.
Yep.
Or it looks a lot more sparse. So anyway,
yep,
great question. Slightly different thoughts on that, but very good question, Logan. I'm going to let you hit Caden because I think Caden's an interesting one.
Caden said, hot take, guys from the Midwest who travel to hunt in Kentucky or Tennessee and claim they are hunting in the Deep South lack brain cells.
And common sense.
And common sense. What's your take on that?
I mean, they're in the SEC. So is Oklahoma, though. Oklahoma's in the SEC. Talk about playing football. Southeastern Conference.
That's true.
Missouri's in it, too.
That's true.
I mean, technically, culturally, there's the culture South and there's like the geographic South. And that gets fought back and forth. But like, I don't really, it doesn't bother me.
It's definitely not the deep South.
Okay. It's definitely not the deep South. 100%. If anything, it'd be like the mid South.
Yeah.
Like kind of area. But, anyways, Caden, a little abrasive there.
Getting a little abrasive.
I don't know. Y'all leave some comments. Do y'all think Kentucky and Tennessee is the deep South?
All right, let's do. Get Dan Austin's question. He said, question based on observation, does anyone else in the South find bucks betting on a south or southwest facing slope as the days get cooler and shorter? I see this consistently every year on my property, especially at one slope in view of a drainage and overlooking a creek. I'm just curious if anyone else has had this observation. I don't think I have. But then again, I really don't pay attention to the bedding that much. Like, because typically our bedding areas are going to be like a whole hill, you know, like not just the southwest side, but all around, because they're cutting. When they come in and they make a clear cut and it makes a bedding thicket, they're cutting usually the entire hill. They're not just cutting a slope.
Yeah.
So it's like, are the deer bedding on that side or are they on the other side of the hill? I don't really know.
To me, it makes more sense than the, depending on what the vegetation looks like, because I am thinking like kind of clear cut. Now, he might not be talking about having a clear cut, but you know, vegetation's like knee high to chest high vegetation. That I could see them maybe not necessarily using the south side a whole bunch early season.
Yeah.
Let alone in the summer where they're cooking. And maybe using the north side a whole bunch. But it don't get that cold. What I notice, and we had somebody on talking about this, is it's like, if it's real cold, deer just like to get out in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever the sun is exposed. And again, it kind of goes back to that question we just answered like a couple minutes ago, talking about like elevation, mm-hmm. like the different terrain and all that stuff. If it's not super, super steep, like ridges and everything, it's like that deer could be laying on the north side of a hill, but ain't steep enough where the sun ain't going to touch it.
Yeah.
If it's cut. Now, if there's timber on it, it's a little bit different, mm-hmm. a little bit different circumstance. But even like thin pines, I mean, it's going to have a little bit of sun come down on that kind of rolling hill country. But yeah, I haven't noticed that a whole bunch. And I don't really, the biggest thing I kind of take in consideration is just the cover and where you're finding sign associated with said cover when you're going in. Like, where does it seem like the deer are actually spending some time? Like, not necessarily walking up in there, but walking the edge of it. Whether it's a, you know, thin timber, it's some kind of clear cut. That'd be the two biggest things for us for like bedding areas, bedding thickets. If you had some kind of wind damage, some kind of down trees and it's understory growing up, just seeing what the sign associated around the edge of it and how the deer are using it. But no, I haven't noticed
more
southeast, west, south facing slopes, whatever.
Yeah, I think that the only days I do try to key in on that from time to time, but it's only when it's really cold. And when I say really cold for us down here, that's like in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe you get your highs don't get out of the 30s. That's like really cold for our part of Alabama.
Yep.
On a day like that, I might pay a little bit more attention to that, but my mind just went to the spot where you remember when me, you, and Zach tripled that day.
Mm-hmm.
And the spot that I was hunting specifically,
mm-hmm.
that spot's south facing, pine thicket, grassy, glady. I mean, like perfect bedding on a cold day. And I killed a buck there. It wasn't when we tripled. It was a different buck that I killed right there. But that, the six point with acorn tips on mm-hmm. his antlers, that deer, it wasn't really that cold that day. It was cold enough to like have a jacket, but it was probably like your typical day down here where it was like 55 degrees maybe. And I killed him right at last light. And I was watching that opening and he did not come out of that opening. He came out of the knob that was off to my right. There's like a little ridge point that came out that was real thick with pines, shady, thick. And he came out of that and he came out at like 8 yards and busted me. And then he tried to swing around me, and that's when he ended up walking. He messed up, and he walked out into that opening that I was looking down into.
Mm-hmm.
He swung around like 100 yards, and he popped out right there, and I was able to get a shot on him. But he was bedded in the thick stuff, you know. And I just bring that up to say that, like, most days down here just aren't really cold enough where I feel like it makes a difference.
No, I think that's, again, a southern thing. It's not that big of a deal unless you're, like, in – if you start getting higher elevations in the south, like North Georgia, and you get a little bit lower temperature drop just because of elevation. Yeah, I could probably see that being a factor. But for most of us in the southeast, I don't think it's something worth putting too much emphasis on. Now, it's interesting. Again, he says, Dan says he sees it. I'm interested in, actually, let me see if I can see where Dan's from. If he put it in his
I think body. He's from Alabama.
Oh, really? I mean, again, I think you could find something like that where you're like, you can kind of prove that to yourself and see that in the area. But I don't know how.
Yeah, like I said.
Oh, he grew up in Wisconsin, deer hunted Tennessee, Alabama. Yeah, he's in Alabama. Okay, interesting.
Grew up in Wisconsin. I wonder if that's where he picked it up from. Dan, you'll have to let us know.
Yeah.
Because, again, like, on those really cold days, when that big cold front rolls in, mm-hmm. front end of it, it's really cold. Again, might not get out of the 30s.
If it's that cold, I'm sitting in an area like a younger clear cut where the deer can come out and they can feed and they get tons of sunlight. And you'll see them literally yep. standing in the sun. Yep. And they'll stand there with their head up, just like trying to warm in the sun.
Yep.
And it's yep. like, yeah.
Yeah, just big old fresh clear
cut. Now, also, I'm thinking of that as a morning hunter.
Yes.
Not hunting afternoons.
Yes.
In afternoons, you still have them come out and that kind of stuff. But morning hunts, you know, you get a clear cut like that with a ton of good vegetation still around, and it's cold. There's deer all in.
Yeah, and that tall broom sedge that's coming up, you know, it's yeah. like hip high.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit taller. And it's just like a big field of grass.
I don't like it with all the grass. I don't want, like, that's hard to see if it's freaking windy. If it's real cold like that, if you're on the front end of that front, it's terrible. You need to be sitting there with snow ski goggles, whatever. Freaking have them on and try to be able to look without your eyes watering. That's the hardest thing, and paying attention to movement. That's tough.
Yeah, what's tough is that wind whipping that grass around.
Yeah,
it's hard to pick up on anything.
It's hard to pick up on a deer because now you're like, you're not even looking for movement. You're looking for something that's not moving.
Yep.
Which is the deer. It's a little bit darker than that grass.
Yep.
It's like complete opposite. It's tough.
Yeah, it is hard. All right, this is from Matt, I don't know how to say your last name. I apologize. You're going to have to jump on a Hunter Hangout meeting and tell us how to pronounce your name. But his question is, are deer in the southeast most likely to bed opposite an elevation of where the food is? So if food is primarily in creek bottoms, will they bed above on the ridges and vice versa? If food is on the ridges, will they bed in the creek bottoms? Or do their bedding patterns just depend on the time of year irrespective of food locations? I need to figure out bedding seems so random and uncertain in South Carolina as if they can bed literally anywhere.
That's the perfect example of
they can bed anywhere.
Yeah, find the food and just it's a lot of trial and error. They got when I think of like that question, I think of Derek Dixon. Gosh, for the longest time, last 4 days, I couldn't remember his last name. Whitetail Research on YouTube, drone operator, been on the podcast before last summer. he looked at that and like with the drone research and talked about like how bucks would kind of bed in like drainages at certain times of year and adjacent to food sources. I want to say he was talking about them. He was surprised how often they'd bed in a drainage. Like
yeah.
kind of lower. Like everybody thought they'd be bedded kind of, everybody talks about them bedded kind of top towards the ridge. He's like some bucks would do that for sure.
Yeah.
And like, you know, wind at their back and all that stuff. But as I said, a lot of times it seemed like they were bedded kind of down in elevation in the drainage adjacent to where there's some white oaks dropping and so on, or red oaks dropping and so on. But that's the hard thing is like, man, if you try to key in on a individual buck bed in the deep south, like South Carolina, where there's typically a ton of good bedding cover, he's got a lot of options and he probably won't be using the same bed very often at all. I mean, MSU, Mississippi State University, Dr. Bronson Strickland, they tested that, and that was in Mississippi, and they got like good feedback and also a lot of negative feedback for some people. He is relative, I think, to the area that they did the study at, but showed like they weren't using the same bed, like mm-hmm. very, like once out of maybe 10 times they might use, once out of 20 times they might use the same bed more than once, but it was like a general area and you could see how the deer was bedded for like this week in this general like 20 acre spot. And you're like more than likely based off his movement at night, like he was kind of doing some jaunts even in early season, but there was clearly probably some oaks dropping in that general area. That's where you're spending time. It's just really hard to kind of key in on that versus just trying to find the good food, try to play the wind, get your axes right and set up and, you know, try to kill those deer. Because I also go back to like the guys in like Arkansas that we've interviewed in eastern Arkansas. Now that's river bottom. They're like, we don't know. Like Richard Falls, like, I don't know where the deer are coming from.
Yeah.
I'm just setting up where I've got the wind advantage. And he's like, it's open woods all around me. They're coming from somewhere. And he's like setting up and just, you're kind of rolling the dice on it. Mm-hmm. That was one reason why he's big into scent control aspect. He's like, I don't know where they're coming from. And that's just the challenging aspect of it. Like, on the flip side, Scott Seals talked about early bow season. He's done this, talked about this on the podcast a couple times. Hunting those skinny little SMZs as hardwood ranges, coming off a creek, going up into some pine stands, finding white that's dropping in there. And just knowing for a fact, he's like, the deer on one side or the other of that drainage feeding. They're like bedded. So he's like, you know, in the mornings, he's trying to slip in there and get in clean. But the afternoons, you know, kind of coming up through the bottom, climbing up, just because, like, the deer on one side of you. You know, they're on the left or they're on the right-hand side. If I can have the wind coming straight down the drainage, you know, I might be pretty good. To me, though, that's how you kind of set yourself up for maybe a little bit more success. Like, more than likely, they're not coming through this wide-open bottom down behind me. They're going to come up from somewhere in front of me up in this thick cover by hunting those fingers. And Anthony, my uncle, talked about that a ton as well in the past and on the show. But, yeah.
That kind of reminds me, too, years ago when I did all that GPS stuff with the GPS point. So long-time listeners will remember this, but years ago, it was Dr. Ditchkoff and some other people at Auburn University did a big GPS study, and they were studying buck home range excursions. So they were basically putting GPS collars on these bucks, recording where their home ranges were, so just the general areas that they hang out the most, and then they were trying to study why they leave those home ranges, like how often do they leave it, how far do they go, why are they doing that. And they wrote a paper on it, and they did it on a couple different pieces of public land in Alabama, as well as a couple hunting clubs. And before I did this for a living, I did GIS for a living. So I did maps and data science and stuff, and I got a hold of that data. So if you went and looked at the paper, they had a link to all the GPS points. So I took those GPS points, put them in my software.
Before AI.
Before AI, it took forever. It took forever. But I plotted them on a map, and we were looking at these bucks, and we were able to see all these GPS points. And what was fascinating about the bedding, because this is also right in the middle of like when buck bedding is still a popular topic, but when it was like all everybody ever talked about. And what was interesting is, one, how they didn't use the same bed. Some of them used the same bed fairly often. Most of them didn't. But really, the deciding factor pretty much always seemed to be cover, like regardless of anything else. Like some of these bucks would go a pretty long way to food after dark at all different times of the year, whether it was on a club or if it was on National Forest or whether it was on a WMA, because there was bucks collared on all those. And we were looking at these GPS points, and a lot of times they were in a drainage. A lot of times they were bedded right off the edge of a saddle or in a saddle that was thick in a pine thicket.
That had a road going over the top of it.
That had a road. A lot of times they were bedded within 50 yards of a road. I mean, a bunch of them. Almost always were bedded within 50 yards of a road, but they were almost always on some little thick patch somewhere near some kind of habitat edge. And to me, it never seemed to really correlate that much with food. Like, I'm thinking of this one buck that was on a particular WMA that me and you have hunted, and he would bed, there was like where these three ridges came together, and he would bed all around those ridges. So where these three ridges come together, you've got drainages coming off all of them, and you've got saddles that kind of connect all of them. And he would bed over here, and then one day he would be in this little bedding spot all day long, never leave it. And then that night, boom, he's down in the creek bottom, and then he's up on the hill, and then he's in a food plot on public ground at night. And then by daybreak, he's in a different saddle, bedded in a different pine thicket, and he stays there all day. And then he does it again. And I don't know, it just never seemed like there was much of a correlation, like where he's trying to bed right next to a food source or bed above or below. And some of the bucks would bed kind of low down. Some of them would bed pretty high up. But it never seemed like, okay, he's bedding up here and then he's dropping straight down or vice versa. I think it's just completely relative to where the best habitat is.
Well, I remember on an episode we did with you, me, I think Pike was on it, talking about how random they were bedding. Mm-hmm. Like, if you knew of all the locations where they were bedding, and this is like well before Mississippi State published their study. I mean, this is 6 years ago, 5, 6 years ago. And like, even if you knew where they were at, it was like a 1 in 8 chance on any individual hunt that you might pick the right spot.
Yes.
Like, if you knew to this spot they he bedded in, any of those bucks, it was like a 1 to 8, 1 to 12 chance within a 30-day window of time that you would, might be in the game.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, oh, you know, it's one of those things where, because we elaborated more talking about it, it was like, if you scouted for any one of these deer, you would just know like a small portion of what he's actually doing, and it'd just be like game of odds at that point.
Yeah.
Like, how many days would you sit it? But also, what's the chance that he's going to smell you in that area either while you're there or after you leave, and then change a little bit? Like, it was a lot to it where, like, it kind of not broke us on the idea of, like, trying to hunt a individual's buck bed or, like, locate an individual's buck bed, but just, like, how they move so much. And, like, a lot of, like, it's not necessarily a huge area, but it makes a world of difference, you know, 300-400-yard stretch that, you know, he could be anywhere in there. How am I going to pick the spot, especially bow hunting, pick the spot where I'm going to get an opportunity at that deer and or not educate that deer that I'm sitting in here because they're moving so much after dark?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a good point, too. What kind of broke us of that whole mindset?
Yeah.
There was one buck in particular. They were, it was all of them that were inconsistent, but there was one in particular that kind of was the perfect poster child of why I quit paying so much attention to individual beds. And there's a video. We put this video up on our Patreon. I did a video on this buck.
When you put it on YouTube.
Yeah, I need to go dig it up and throw it out there. But it was one buck, and he bedded. There's a big hillside of thinned pines, big pine plantation that were clearly thinned, definitely thick underneath. I didn't go to it, but reading it on the map, like, I know what it looks like. And big pine hill with draws running all up in it and everything. And then in the bottom was a pretty wide hardwood creek drainage. And this buck, if I remember right, bedded in that pine thicket all day and then went straight down to that hardwood drainage every day and night for like 28 days in a row. So he bedded in the same pine thicket and went to the same hardwood bottom within a couple hundred yards every single night for 28 days in a row, almost a month. And the reason that it broke me of that is because he bedded in a different spot every single day, and he entered the creek bottom in a different spot every single day. And he might, you know, all I can assume with that is, one, he could bed anywhere in the pine thicket, because that pine thicket, it's a monoculture. It's all the same all the way through. It's nothing but loblolly pines. They thinned it, and so the cover in there is pretty much the same throughout the whole thing. So he can kind of lay down anywhere, and he's got natural food in there. He's got honeysuckle and briars and browse and all kinds of stuff he can eat. And then in the bottom, that was probably a pretty good mast year, and a lot of those trees produced. So he was just kind of ping-ponging back and forth between that pine thicket and then down in the bottom, pine thicket down in the bottom for a month straight. And the reason that it messed me up is, like, man, you could walk into that pine thicket, and we've done it a bunch of times. You could walk into that pine thicket, and you could go find beds. You could go find beds with rubs in them. You could go find beds with droppings in them and hair in them and, like, whatever. But he wasn't using the same bed over and over and over again. And that particular buck was, you know, bedding high and then going low to food every night. But we saw other ones that did the exact opposite of that, where they would bed low, and then they'd end up going high after dark. So I just don't know if it's consistent enough. That's where the sign reading comes in.
Yeah.
And where, if, like, on that particular buck that I'm using as an example, the way to kill that buck would have been, you know, now that we could see what he was doing, like, if some guy didn't know that buck was there, the guy who would probably end up killing that buck would be the guy that walked in and just scouted that edge really good between the pines and the hardwoods, found some big exit trails, and found some hot feed trees, assuming maybe that buck probably laid down a couple rubs when he was in there. And if you just hunted it and tried to hunt it real clean for a couple days, you'd probably see him at some point. As long as your wind was right and you were quiet getting in and out, you would probably have an encounter with him in that situation, but if you could read the sign.
And sitting over those hot trees, because like I said, he was kind of working through different areas of that bottom. The same tree is not going to be great for 3 weeks. So it's like there's certain trees they're going to go to, and it's like finding that freshest, hottest sign and also correlating that with some buck sign. That's where your success is going to come in, which goes back to, like, some of the feed tree guys we've had on the podcast. None of them typically care all that much about the bedding.
Yeah.
Like, some of them are like, you know, okay, if I find a really hot tree with buck sign on it really close to the bedding cover, great. That's something to pay attention to. But a lot of times this is the best sign possible on a feed tree that makes sense for them to come through during daylight hours and set up on it, especially early season. Everything's still green. But yeah, I mean, looking at all that data, it was like, it made you realize in a lot of circumstances how truly lucky you are to kill a buck.
Yes.
I mean, literally. 100%. I was like, oh, it's skill. There is a lot of luck involved. I don't care what someone says. You've got to have a little bit of luck on your side.
Yeah.
You have to.
Agree.
Because they're a wild animal, and they ain't going to do always the same thing over and over again.
And that's why the skill is the sign reading and understanding the woodsmanship, understanding what's going on when you walk into a situation like that, and you're like, man, there's really good bedding right here. There's sign down in the bottom, and just hunt it as clean as you can a couple times, because he was feeding and entering that bottom in different spots most nights, but it was only like a 200-300 yard area that he was doing it. That's not really that big of an area, especially if he's milling around and going from tree to tree. So that's why I'm saying, if you could hunt it clean under good conditions a couple times, you'd have a pretty good chance of seeing that buck in a situation like that where he's being that consistent, even though there's like a pretty good amount of randomness involved with what he's doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the only thing that we don't know this information is how many acorn-producing oaks,
yep,
were in that bottom that were producing acorns. Because I think that's like the benefit of hunting an area where there's limited oaks that are dropping. I'm not even talking like a sparse tree, but just an area you don't have that many oaks, that if they're truly drawn to that tree, it's less option for them to get distracted on.
Yeah.
So it makes you be able where you can hone down a little bit tighter during that window of time when those trees are really, really producing. Versus an area where it's like just a big bottom. There's tons of oaks, tons of white oaks, tons of red oaks, and can make it really challenging. Actually, I think Greg Mayher talked a little bit about that when we hunted with him in Georgia last year.
Yeah.
Was like the difference between like some of the isolated white oaks that like he knew historical, or like these are always typically good trees, but there's not a bunch of them. There's a couple of them here. First, like what he talked about, those long bands of oaks, or like you have it kind of just running through the timber. And he's like, had more success like killing bucks on those, just when you can find a couple trees that are hot and sitting there, and they just like work the whole tree, that the whole edge of those, all those white oaks. He's like, you might not be over the hot tree, but he's walking down all these white oaks to try to get to the next good one. And he's like, this is all spread out like the sign. So, but it's challenging. But yeah, kind of goes back to like, there is a skill set, and kind of, answering his question, not worrying so much about the actual, his beds, but it's figuring out what is the hottest food source right then, the hottest trees, and then trying to isolate those and hunt those. Kind of also goes back to like when we had Lindsey Thomas Jr. on the podcast discussing like food is like one of the major factors for getting a deer on his feet.
Yep.
But he's like, there's tons of quote-unquote, for all audio listeners, quote-unquote, food out there for him, but there's certain times when certain things are the hottest. And figuring out what that is on the fly is how you're able to stay on deer and stay on what the bucks are really wanting to feed on, and also what trees they want to go to. So I think if you kind of put all that into your mindset when you go out there and focus on that, you probably have a lot more opportunities and see a lot more deer, and just have more opportunities to shoot them than necessarily trying to sit one individual trail coming out of one bedding area that they have a bunch of other ways come out and just try to, you know, play poker on it and just see if you can hit it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty common subject on the old circle group, I've noticed, is bedding. That comes up quite a bit, more than I thought that it would.
Yeah.
And that's why whenever I'm responding to people on there, I'm like, man, I wouldn't worry about the beds. Just learn what a bedding area looks like and go off of that.
Yeah, like what is good bedding cover? Where do you see deer? It's pretty easy to identify. I mean, if you really want to check it out, go walking through that stuff and see how many deer you jump out. I mean, to be 100% honest, like, oh, bedding area, cool, mark it out, put a polygon on it, on Onyx, and move on, and then kind of correlate between all the different bedding areas and some of the hottest feeding areas around there, and then key in on that and have some success.
All right, let's do, this is a good one. This is a hot take from Patrick Hurd. He said, mesh cheap Bass Pro leafy suit is the most versatile camo at the cheapest cost. I wear a bathing suit and a t-shirt for August-September hunts when it's 90-degree weather. Winter, I can wear a long sleeve shirt and a flannel with jeans. No matter what, I don't have to buy any camo besides a leafy suit and don't need any other camo whatsoever. And it has a hood. And a thermocell is a necessity. I like hunting in a bathing suit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is kind of a hot take. But it's also just a simplistic way to hunt and not have to worry about having a bunch of different camo garments that you're going to use throughout the whole season. I mean, you can keep it super simple, like Lee said. I got no problem with that at all. And I've met guys who did that. I mean, just kept it super simple, run a leaf suit and be done with it. So yeah, Patrick, good take, hot take, but good take.
Yep. It doesn't have to be expensive, man.
Yeah.
Just
keep it simple. Kind of goes back to, again, weeks ago, we talked about like things you need if you're going to go hunting, and pretty much it's a place to go hunt and a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then if you want to add camo, you're trying to do it as cheap as possible. A leaf suit wouldn't be a bad option, and then wear whatever clothes you feel comfortable wearing underneath it. Another one, I'll read this one, is from Case Bog. I think he's, if I remember right, he's in Mississippi. His question, it's not a hot take, but a question. He's talking about bow hunting from the ground in flat river bottoms. Would it be risky and hunt directly set up on feed tree? Okay. Lord. Case. Okay.
Not bad punctuation. That's fine.
Okay. Well,
that is proper sentence structure.
I will restart for all you guys, and I apologize to everybody watching and listening. Case's question is, bow hunting from the ground in flat river bottoms, would it be risky and hunt directly?
Okay, wait.
Yeah, what do you
I see it
about?
Now. Okay.
You can't read
well,
it.
Well, I speed read it. I can pick it up.
Okay, I mean, would it be risky to hunt and set up directly under feed trees? I'm going to paraphrase here. Set up directly on feed trees, or play it safe and hunt the trails heading to a hot feed tree. So again, hunting from the ground, would it be more risky to set up on the feed tree on the ground, or to, is it better to set up on the trails going to it? My thought would be I'd set up on the feed tree. That's just my thing.
On the ground.
You better find you a good spot to set up in.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing is cover. I don't care what kind of suit you have. Even if you want to wear a ghillie suit, I promise you the average person is still going to be moving a little bit.
Like, yeah.
You got to be still, but having some kind of vegetation cover where you can kind of set up accordingly. Problem is hunting on the ground early season like that. He's river bottom. River bottom, some of that stuff could be wide, slap, open.
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of going back to the thing about Richard Fott. Now he's, I mean, he'd hunt early season, but you know, his time to shine is pre-rut, rut, and post-rut. But if you can find good cover close to the feed tree, I don't think that's a terrible option. The thing is how to find, can you find those trails from a bedding area in early season out there?
Yeah.
Because for me, a lot of times, early season is kind of like the hardest time to find trails because you get old leaves, you don't have new leaves falling off trees and all that stuff. But it's the vegetation, even like just low vegetation, it makes it to me a little bit harder to see those trails and find those trails versus a little bit later on in the season, or kind of, you know, you get into after leaves fall and everything, and the deer using for a while, it's a little more pronounced. But my thought would be hunt the actual tree itself for an opportunity, just shoot a doe or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you could isolate a good trail, sure, try it. Absolutely. I think on the trail, you get away with a lot more opportunity. Or you hunting the trail, if you found a defined trail, the deer aren't going to be spending a lot of time in front of you, so they're just kind of walking through, which I think is a good thing, as in less opportunity for them to see you, but also making sure that you have an opportunity to be able to execute a shot on the ground with vegetation, be able to shoot through stuff or have a little lane, you know, trimmed out, even sitting on the ground. Versus a feed tree, the thing about the feed tree is, yeah, they're spending more time in front of you, higher chance of you get busted because they're spending more time in front of you, and it's the place they actually want to get to, but also gives you a little bit more time to try to pick that shot when they come in.
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I agree. And it kind of reminds me of Travis Murray, too, and Travis talking about this kind of thing, because he ground hunts a lot with a traditional bow, and he said that he doesn't like hunting food sources on the ground because they're so much more alert when they're at that food source. And kind of like you said, the double-edged sword, though, is those feed trees, like, you don't really know where they're going to come from. I mean, they could come from anywhere, any direction when they're coming to a feed tree. And so if you isolate yourself to one trail off that feed tree, you're probably giving up opportunities. are your chances of getting busted are lower, but if you're on the feed tree, you're probably going to see more deer. So, you know, kind of like you said, just make sure you got good cover. If you got really, really, really good cover, you know, you could be in good shape. So
one thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LIDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LIDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LIDAR is now available on OnX Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LIDAR feature and boom, it's gonna come on and you're gonna see what I'm talking about. The LIDAR is gonna allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LIDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LIDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on OnX Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your OnX Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LIDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with OnX Hunt.
Especially if you go look for feed trees right now, which I've been doing lately. And dude, I'll tell you what, I've been seeing a lot of acorns in the trees, like last year. I mean, I don't know if it's quite as heavy as last year, but I haven't checked. I don't know if I've checked a tree yet that doesn't have mast in it. So looks like we're gonna have another good one, boys, which a lot of people don't like. I love it. I don't mind it one bit. I like it when we have good years. I struggle in years where there's no mast.
Yeah.
So I was telling people at the Deer Expo this past weekend that as they're scouting over these next couple weeks, getting in the woods a little bit, putting cameras out, looking around, hanging stands, be looking at your oak trees and start checking your crop and see if they produced acorns this year. What's it looking like? Is it another bumper year? Is it just an average year? Is it a bust year for your area? And start writing those in because we want to start giving some reports as we get closer to deer season for different areas. I know that I saw Dylan Harper post the other day. He was on the show about a month or two ago. North Georgia guy. He has been checking trees all over the mountains up there in North Georgia, and he said it's another bumper year. So he's seeing plenty of acorns all over the place. So I'm curious what other people are saying too. It kind of seems like it might be the case in Central Alabama too. So I want some reports.
If that's the case, guys, if it comes out to be another bumper year, don't be relying on your corn piles on private land and or food plots. Like, yep, you're going to have to get off in the woods. That's one reason why harvest numbers were so low last year across the southeast. But, yeah, that'd be interesting. Got one more, Andrew. I'm going to let you read this.
Which one is this?
Second to last, Corey Clayton.
All right, Corey Clayton.
Got a question.
Last season on some public land, on the public land I hunt, they planted millet or milo, as I've heard it called in the past, which was the first time I've seen this be planted on this property in 12 years of hunting it. I found some deer around it, but not necessarily eating it that I could tell. I've heard in other states that this can be a great food source for deer. Curious on y'all's thoughts about this and if you've ever hunted near or around it. Appreciate it, fellas. I've hunted around millet, specifically dove fields, and had fantastic luck. Not on the seed heads per se, but I'm talking about, this was in Georgia when I was doing this. When that millet's growing and it's green, or when it reseeds and starts coming back up, they hammer it. They like it. Especially certain kinds of millet. A lot of people plant, what is it, brown top millet for doves? I don't know if that's what they planted here or not, but there's a lot of different varieties of millet. Is millet and milo the same thing? I don't think so.
No.
Two separate plants. There's some types of millet that are more of like a forage millet, though. So like pearl millet is, it puts a seed head on, but it's more for like livestock feed. So it doesn't have as many seeds, but it's got more broad leaves on it. And the deer hammer that stuff. I got some sometime for no reason at all. And I threw it out trying to, that's all I could find. And I threw it out in a clear cut, just trying to get me a little dove spot going. And the deer absolutely mowed it down. But you've had you or your uncle, right? Hunting around Milo, has had luck?
Sorghum, not Miller Milo. Sorghum had success with deer. Like when it matures, they eat the fire out the heads of it.
Is sorghum and Milo the same thing?
No.
I don't know what Milo is, to be honest with y'all. I've never had any experience with Milo whatsoever, but I've heard that they do. I think Grant Woods talks a lot about Milo. I feel like I've seen him plant it on some of his videos. They probably do eat it when it's green, and then the seed heads as well when those seed heads mature, because that's what y'all saw with the sorghum, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually gonna look at this up real quick.
We're gonna fact check this in real time, boys, real time. But yeah, dovefields are kind of overlooked because people assume that the deer just aren't going to be around them because of all the shooting, but I don't think they really know what the shooting is, or they're not that threatened by it, because I don't really know what the case is there. But even here in Alabama on some dove fields, you'll find quite a bit of dove sign. Like, you know, we used to shoot that dove field on our local WMA quite a bit, and you'd shoot a bird and it would go off the edge of the field, and you'd be looking around over there trying to find your bird. This is before we had dogs. And dude, the deer sign you'd find around that thing is just crazy. And then also in the field, you'd find droppings and tracks and everything. Like, they use those fields, sure.
I got clarification on you. Milo is actually a grain sorghum. Where sorghum is like, the sorghum as itself is a broad name for a bunch of different, I guess, varieties.
Okay.
But Milo is in that sorghum category.
So I was right.
Millet is completely different. Millet is like a seeding grass.
Yeah.
So yeah, if it's Milo, it could, I mean, it's type of sorghum, which that looks vastly different from millet.
Yeah.
Like, sorghum looks vastly different from millet. So anyway, but that's interesting. They're planting, I mean, if they're planting that on that place, it might be, I don't know if they have it set up as a dove plot. But yeah, if it's a type of sorghum, millet, or not millet, more Milo, be absolutely hammering that, depending on the variety of it, once it fully matures.
Yep.
Like some of those dove fields we talk about, I mean, I've hunted around some dove fields as well. And now the deer were eating sunflower heads like crazy, sticking their face up in it and just like munching on a whole seed head, but still even eating some of the sorghum that was in it.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing. You know, and it makes sense. You know, you remember one time we talked to Bronson Strickland about food plot sizes, and he was saying that based on their studies that kind of the optimum food plot size, especially for bucks, is like the 4 to 5 acre size, which is a big food plot. And most people don't have that. They don't have the capacity to plant that big of a food plot on their place. But there are, if you think about what are some of the bigger plots that people end up planting, it's usually a dove field. And they're not necessarily planting, you know, deer food there. They're not planting like clover and stuff. But some of the other things that they plant for doves, deer will also eat. And so that's a pretty big field. It's a big food source. And again, it's just something that you can kind of key in on if you've got a place on maybe a hunting club or a lease or some local public ground where there's a dove field. That's something worth checking out around the edges of it, because that's a big opening with a lot of food in it that's going to draw deer. So, you know, just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind as you go looking around and whatnot. But we got one video question that I wanted to do as well. This came from the website. This is from James in Indiana, and the subject is camera location.
What's up, fellas? Get a little cardio in here. Quick question for you. With limited cam access, and my main mission with the cameras is not to locate a specific deer or hunt a specific deer, but just to ID deer in the general area I'm going to be going, would you guys say set the camera up on a pinch point or a Y in the trail or a Y in a logging road? Thanks for the insight. Stay southern.
Nice. Appreciate the question, James. Getting after it. Getting in shape, dude.
Getting after it. Yeah, I made the comment while we were watching it. I'm like, if I was running and having to ask a question, did it shoot? I need all the air I can get. Come
take
on
you
10 now.
10 minutes to get the question.
Yeah,
out.
I got to get all the air I can get.
Impressive.
How is that worse?
I like putting my cameras on trail intersections, so Ys and trails. When you talk about putting a camera on a pinch point, it really just depends on the pinch point. If there's a trail around that pinch point, that's great. With some pinch points, there's usually just not really a great trail right there, and it depends on how wide the pinch point is. my mind immediately goes to some places that we used to hunt in South Alabama, where you had these relatively open fields, and then you had little blocks of timber that ran in between them. And that's kind of your pinch point where the deer pinching around the sides of those fields are not, they're trying to not go out in the open. They're trying to stay in the timber. And so those corners are usually good where they're cutting around a corner. Camera placement can be kind of hit or miss on places like that, where if your pinch point's 50 to 80 to 100 yards wide and you just try to put a camera looking out across it, it really depends on how capable your camera is and what the like trigger distance or whatever they call it is on that camera. I've had some that trigger really well out to 50 yards. I have some that don't trigger well at 20 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And even the same brands, sometimes just different cameras are just, I don't know, they just don't work as good. But that's why I like putting them on Y intersections and trails. That's what I grew up doing, is hunting just intersections and trails. And I've had a lot of luck putting cameras on intersections like that. And it can tell you a lot about direction of travel. There's a place I used to hunt where I put a camera on a trail intersection. I ended up killing a couple deer in this spot. But in that particular spot, I only got deer ever on that trail. I only got them going one direction, and I only got them when the wind was a certain direction. It was like a north wind or something. And that's kind of what got me initially interested. I mean, this was probably 2016. That's what initially got me interested in deer traveling with the wind. Because as I started going back through and looking, I'm like, man, every single time a deer comes through here, he's heading that direction, and it's always a north wind. And for some reason, that trail, that's the conditions they used to that. And I think the reason that I started looking at it like that is because I remember when I was a kid hunting with Benny, we would find these giant trails just carved into the side of the hill, big deer trails. I'd be like, why are we not hunting this deer trail? And he's like, this is a night trail. They only use this at night. I'm like, how do you know that? Well, it's because he hunted it a bunch of times and never saw anything. But the trail's there, so they're using it. There's a trail, but he just never saw deer there in daylight, so it must be a night trail. I would put it on trail intersections. Log and road intersections can be good. Those can sometimes be a little bit less defined, where the deer can walk anywhere on that, you know, 6, 7, 8 foot wide road. So maybe there's not a defined trail there. And if it's covered with pine straw, there might not even be tracks there that you can really see.
But getting into that pre-rut, mid pre-rut, or pre-rut into the early section of the rut, the amount of scrapes that could open up, especially if historically you found mm-hmm. scrapes pop up in those areas, great place to put a camera. Couple weeks before, typically you'd see scrapes,
yeah,
and get inventory of when those bucks come through there, and also what kind of quality you're seeing.
Yep,
because I want to say a circle member made a post about that recently, where I have to find it. Where is an air? Oh no, yeah, well no, I met the guy in Alabama. I met him at the World Deer Expo. He's a circle member, and he was talking about, he was trying to compile this, and he's got posting on circle. That's what it was. He got some giants on camera. You know who you are. We talked for a long time, him and his wife, okay? I'm talking about put what we got on camera to shame, okay?
Okay.
I'm
eager to see this.
Any giant deer. But he was he implemented what, talking about trail cameras, still with this conversation, what Daniel Williams had talked about with annual patterns and bucks running these big rut circuits and loops, and like finding these loops through rubs and also implementing scrapes. Anyways, he started doing that and putting trail cameras. And it started out with one rub that he found this one area on the piece of public land, threw a camera up on it, and having a couple bucks kind of use that rub, but he put the camera back there early season last year.
Oh, yeah, I talked to him.
Okay, I know you talked to him, yeah. And literally having like 10 different bucks all hit the same rub.
Oh, dude, yeah, he had some good deer.
He had some junk, dude. I'm talking some big ones. But then it started expanding from that. So he started literally just with this one rub and expanded out from that to like scrapes and everything else. He's got cameras all in this one area. And his inventory was very interesting. And also trying to figure out, like, there's some places he's getting photos of deer that he's like, it's just too hard to hunt it. He's like, the wind swirls are coming in from, you know, different yep. areas. You know, they're kind of low in the bottom, but I got to be up high on the ridge for the wind and all that kind of stuff. But just he planned out where he thought the deer would be using it after 1 year of kind of messing around with it, the following season ended up catching all these bucks using this area and laying down all this fresh line just by prepping his cameras and putting them out there a little earlier. So I think that's a really good idea, and it's kind of what we're talking about with the logging roads. Like, not all logging roads are like that, but if you've walked, like, think back through your head, certain log roads in the past, and I've got a couple in mind, where you have, it always seems like there are scrapes that pop up on it, and, you know, they just lay down a bunch of sign. It's a great spot to put a camera. Mm-hmm. You know, a few, you know, two, three, maybe even 4 weeks before the rut, is really happening there, they try to get some inventory of when those bucks are using it, how they start laying down that sign, and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. I found a good trail intersection this morning. I was out running my dogs this morning, and I found one that I did not know was there, and it is a good one. I mean, perfect heavy trail and just forks out into a perfect Y. And I'm probably going to put a camera right there. I love putting cameras in spots like that. Because sometimes those trails, they'll be dead as a doornail for like 2 months, and then one day that just bam, they turn on. Mm-hmm. And they start using them. Mm-hmm. And that's really valuable information to have. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're going to hunt that individual trail, or it can just tell you about what areas the deer may be shifting into and starting to move on, or whatever the case may be. So I put a camera near it, though. I put it on a big old scrape this morning. Big old scrape. Let Truvian Boone wallow in the scrape and pee in it. So we'll see how that turns out. Mm-hmm. I made the comment, I did a video on that for Circle, and I was like, man, I get so many videos of coyotes peeing in scrapes mm-hmm. and rolling in them. I don't think it matters, at all. So,
no.
But anyways, put a camera on that this morning. And that trail, actually, where that fork in the trail is, one of them kind of goes up a hill, kind of cuts up and around this crow's foot that I was in. And then the other one goes down into the bottom, and then it just kind of dissipates a little bit. It's kind of hard to pick up where it's at. But if you keep following it, first of all, I went in there in February, and it was slam full of rubs. I mean, rubs everywhere, big rubs. And this was after Mike and I both killed bucks in there. So some other bucks in there making rubs. I don't know. I have an idea what buck it might be, but I don't know for sure. But anyways, that trail goes down past all those rubs and then ends up at a really nice scrape, really, really nice scrape. And so I put the camera where it's looking at one big scrape, and then there's a little secondary scrape a little bit past it, and then a little bit past that is where what's left of that trail goes past it. So I'm looking at both scrapes and that trail, so I'm very eager to see what shows up on that camera, because it's low down, creek drainage, bunch of white oaks in there. And so kind of my prediction for this spot, we'll have to see if this comes true. My prediction is I might get some bucks on it right now, like if there's a bachelor group that happens to be hanging out down there. But what I think is going to happen is once we get into September and October and some of those oaks start dropping, a couple of mountain oaks in there, a couple of white oaks, once they start dropping, I think I'm going to have all kinds of deer on that camera. Whether or not I can hunt down in there, different story. I think I will be able to, but it'll have to be real particular days that I can go. But eager to try that spot out.
What are you going to name that spot so we can keep up with it, so I can ask you about it?
I don't know.
You can't be scrape white oaks.
I'll name it the Crow Foot.
The Crow Foot?
Yep.
Okay.
It's a high crow's foot.
Okay.
Josh Driver. All the OG listeners know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, look up Southern Outdoorsman Josh Driver, and he'll explain it.
Yeah. Sweet. That's all the questions.
Yeah, I think that's all the questions.
Okay. Couple other updates with us. We haven't talked about this, but we've been planting some food plots, planting some Dirt Doctor. Logging deck, logging roads, got caught by a rainstorm on another little logging road spot.
Yep.
So that one didn't turn out for it. poor Sea Dog getting soaking wet. Got that again, just finished at the World Deer Expo, getting ready for Mobile Hunter Expo coming up again, Dalton, Georgia. Mentioned that earlier on. If you've been watching this podcast, you've seen me in our brand new Faded Bobland Freezer Queen shirt. These are some hot sellers, okay?
Yes.
I got some more ordered for the Mobile Hunter Expo. They are not on the website yet. So if you want one of these shirts, some of our other stuff that we brought out, it's kind of a limited run. It'll be at the Mobile Hunter Expo, so y'all come check that out. Also, if y'all just want a couple normal Freezer Queens, solid colors, along with all of our other shirts and hats we got on, you can head over to southernoutdoorsman.com, check those out. Appreciate everybody's been purchasing some new apparel. And it was cool meeting people, seeing people again at the World Deer Expo. They had some Southern Outdoors hats and shirts on anyway, so it was pretty cool to kind of see that. So appreciate all y'all's support. Thank y'all for watching. Thank y'all for hopping on Circle. All the Circle members leaving us some hot takes and questions. And again, if you want to submit a listener Q&A video question, go over to our website right now, and that's how you can kind of get featured on the show. Kind of like the one gentleman, which I already forgot his name. It was kind of terrible I said that. But yeah, if you want to be featured on the show or video on the show, ask us a question, head over to thesunoutdoorsman.com. There's a way you can kind of submit that video question there. So thank y'all for watching. Thank y'all for listening. We'll catch you back in the next episode from the Southern Outdoorsman. And remember, guys, y'all stay southern.
Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. Is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo lets you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and know it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.